Illinois lawmakers in recent months have proposed creating safe zones for people in the country illegally. Some cities like Urbana and Chicago call themselves sanctuaries. Law expert Vikram Amar says there's a new tension between state and local governments and federal officials.
Prior to today, the disputes involved situations where states were trying to be more aggressive than the feds. Now it's inverted. You have a lot of blue cities and states that want to be more restrained, but the federal government is being more aggressive.
What questions do you have about this situation? You can tweet to 21st Show or call us now at 1-800-222-9455, plus the Illinois connection to the Trail of Tears.
You know, this happened to our people, and people don't really... people forget about it. People forget about the Trail of Tears. And people need to see this kind of stuff. They need to understand the history.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. With the Trump administration taking a more aggressive stance on immigration, state and local authorities have responded in very different ways. Some officials who support the president, like Texas Governor Greg Abbott, have signed laws cracking down on so-called sanctuary cities, while other mayors, governors, and local leaders, especially here in Illinois, have promised to welcome immigrants who are here without authorization. There's so much talk and headlines about this today. We wanted to take a step back to understand exactly what local municipalities and states can and cannot do on this issue. We've been gathering your questions all this week on social media. We'll get to those. We've got two legal experts with us this hour to help make sense of this all. If you're listening right now and you want to chime in, it's not too late. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet. Our handle is 21stshow. We'll try to get to your questions. On the line with me now is Vikram Amar, a constitutional law scholar who's also dean of the University of Illinois College of Law. Dean Amar, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla.
Vic, I feel like we're in an interesting time here where prior to the Trump administration, I think certainly during the Obama administration, we saw states challenging the federal government over issues like abortion and health care coverage. This is a little bit different, is it?
Well, yes and no. There were states that challenged the Obama administration over immigration, but they tended to be very conservative states that wanted to regulate persons who were in the United States who weren't citizens more aggressively than the federal government. So, for example, you had a famous case get to the Supreme Court from the state of Arizona, in which Arizona had passed laws that tried to regulate non-citizens more forcefully than the federal immigration law, and the Supreme Court struck that down. What you see now are movements at the state and local level to want to treat immigrants less aggressively than the federal government seems to be wanting to do. And the question becomes exactly what power states and localities have to go their own way.
Yeah, that's a big question, and we're going to get into that this hour with Vikram Amar. Joining us in a few minutes as well, Sarah Dady, an immigration attorney in Rockford. Rockford and sheriffs in particular, Winnebago County Sheriff Gary Caruana, has found himself at the middle of this debate over the past few months. He came under criticism for his proposal that the Rockford area use vacant space to house ICE detainees. A few weeks ago, Sheriff Caruana did say that ICE could not agree to meet certain criteria and they would not be going forward with that plan. Sheriff's offices, of course, are tasked with working closely with all federal authorities, whether they're ICE or otherwise. We're joined now by Greg Sullivan, who's executive director of the Illinois Sheriff's Association. Greg, thanks for taking the time to join us this morning.
Sure, Nyla. Glad to do it.
Greg, in April, you all, the Sheriff's Association, put out a statement that says, in part, sheriffs take an oath to obey local, state, and federal laws and will cooperate with federal immigration officials. The same day that the Sheriff's Association put out that statement, Democrats in the Illinois Senate were advocating for a bill known as the Trust Act. One part of that would create immigrant safe zones in places like state supported schools and hospitals that would bar local law enforcement from entering those areas without a warrant. Was the association statement in response to those proposals, the statement that you all put out, Greg?
Yes. Senate Bill 31, which was introduced by President Cullerton, it's not the first time we've seen it. It was introduced in prior the 99th General Assembly. But the bill as written initially and as introduced, put a lot of restrictions on law enforcement that were, quite frankly, unlivable.
And when you say unlivable, what do you mean by that?
Well, for example, one of the safe zones would have been the courthouse. So, and you, we, under the way it was written, the only thing we could arrest anybody for in a courthouse would have been a criminal violation or a criminal warrant. So if we had a civil warrant or somebody was found in civil contempt of court, didn't pay their child support, for example, we wouldn't have been able to make arrest on our own courthouses. That's not livable.
Mm-hmm. So in a sense, obviously, I imagine you feel like sheriffs are kind of being put in conflict with sanctuary cities or these different maybe laws that different municipalities, or in this case, this proposal put forward by Senate Democrats. Do you feel like that puts sheriffs in a difficult position?
Well, it put us in a precarious position when there was a right to civil action by anyone for sheriffs cooperating with ICE. Sheriffs take an oath of office. That oath of office includes upholding federal law.
So what advice is the association giving individual sheriffs? Do you all feel like you need to be providing legal advice in addition to the statement that you put out?
Well, a couple of things. We believe that, number one, training is essential. We also have renegotiated the Senate Bill 31. We don't believe that we should be honoring any civil detainers that have not been reviewed by a judge. If it's, and according to the Seventh Circuit District and the Ninth Circuit District, that's exactly what they're saying is, that if it's not been signed by an authorized judge or the Attorney General, we shouldn't be honoring them. So, and that's the advice we're giving our sheriffs.
Mm-hmm. Greg, I also wonder, as we think about the fact that traditionally sheriffs are elected officials, your statement says they shouldn't bend to political pressure. That's a tough line. Do you think that's a tough line for your sheriffs to walk?
Well, it is a tough line for them to walk because they are elected and they're responsible to the citizens. They're accountable. But at the same time, when you have groups that are pushing, you know, we understand if you want to help victims of human trafficking, we're all for it. We're here to help. You want to improve the number of certifications that are done for victims? That's part of the training that we need for our officers so that they understand what that entails. We think with the wave of immigration discussions that are going on across the country, it's important that we at least have someone in our offices who have been trained on immigration law, and we know what's going on. And one of the things we believe is that, you know, the state's attorney is our attorneys across the state. So we want to make sure that they have people trained under immigration law so they can guide us through the process.
Thanks for that. That's Greg Sullivan. He's executive director of the Illinois Sheriff's Association. Greg, I appreciate you taking the time to join us.
My pleasure, Nyla.
We're talking about the role. We were just talking about sheriffs, other local municipalities and states versus the federal government when it comes to immigration enforcement. On the line with us is constitutional law scholar Vikram Amar, who's also dean of U of I's law school. In studio with me here in Chicago is Sarah Dady. She's an immigration attorney from Rockford, practicing at the firm Dady & Hoffman. She was recently on the program to talk about the proposed facility for ICE detainees that Sheriff Gary Caruana recently said they're not moving forward with. Sarah, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla.
Sarah, we heard Greg talk about civil detainers. Can you explain that for people who aren't familiar with this? Because this is something, I think, a term a lot of people have heard in the news, and this has been caused some, you know, not, as you heard Greg say, not without controversy.
Sure. Federal immigration law is civil law. So when the Department of Homeland Security charges someone with being unlawfully present in the United States or any other immigration violation, that's a civil violation. It's not a crime. We have a separate criminal code. There's a separate federal criminal code. But immigration violations are civil. And I found it interesting that Mr. Sullivan said that the Sheriff's Association does agree that any immigration arrest warrant should be reviewed by a judge and signed by a judge, because immigration arrest warrants are administrative warrants, which means they are never signed by a judge. They're only signed by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer. So right there, I think we have agreement in our state that there shouldn't be federal immigration arrests taking place without a judicial warrant. And by definition, ICE warrants are not judicial warrants.
Vic, I wonder if you could weigh in here as well, because we heard Greg Sullivan talking about precedent. There's been some legal precedent about this in terms of the civil detainers. Can you talk about that for a little bit, just sort of what the law says?
Sure, sure. So as Mr. Sullivan said, all officials take an oath to uphold federal as well as state law. And no one thinks that local officials can interfere with the feds as they try to independently enforce immigration law. No matter what one's political views, one cannot lie to the federal government or obstruct the federal government or in any other way interfere with it. The real question becomes what obligation, if any, state and local officials have to cooperate with or help federal enforcement officials. So detainers are one example where the federal government will ask local authorities to hold on to somebody so that the feds have a chance to come interview and or arrest and or start processing for deportation or other outcomes of that individual. Under the federal constitution, state and local officials have no obligation to assist the federal government. Indeed, they have the latitude not to assist the federal government. They cannot be forced or ordered or mandated to assist the federal government, even as they cannot interfere with the federal government in any way. But there are two caveats I might mention in that regard. The cases the Supreme Court decided in the 90s that identified this so-called anti-commandeering principle, the idea that the federal government cannot commandeer state and local officials to do the federal government's job, that might not apply to information requests that don't require the state and local official to do anything other than turn over information. So there might be a difference under federal Supreme Court case law between a request or demand by the federal government that locals turn over information they have in their files about non-citizens versus a request or demand that the federal government might make that state or local officials actually take some action, like perform some investigation or hold on to somebody so that the feds can get there. Those latter things clearly fall within this anti-commandeering principle, and it's up to each state to decide how to cooperate or not.
Except, and is it also
the other big
right? Oh, go ahead. Do your exception, and then I have a follow-up question.
Okay.
Go ahead, Vic.
So the other big caveat is to say that the federal government can't mandate or force states and locals to do anything affirmative doesn't mean that the feds can't use the power of the purse, the federal dollars, to provide a strong incentive for states and locals to cooperate. So the federal government can condition federal monies on a promise by state and locals that they assist the federal government in any one of a number of ways. So, for example, if Congress passed a law that said states or cities are going to get money for their local police departments to do all kinds of investigations, but then they have to also assist federal law enforcement authorities, including civil enforcement authorities like Homeland Security, then if the cities and states accept that money, then they are obligated to provide assistance, even though in the absence of that money, they wouldn't have to. So a lot of these disputes over, you know, what cities and states can do at the end of the day are going to turn on what kind of funding has been conditioned on cooperation, and that's a very statute-by-statute specific kind of inquiry.
To that point, we had a listener question. We've been gathering questions from folks on social media, and we had a question on Reddit about actually the University of Illinois saying that if the University of Illinois or if any university in the state, for that matter, fails to comply with requests from federal governments, could the university's funding get cut?
So, again, let's put aside information-only requests for one moment, because under the two big Supreme Court cases, that it's not clear how they fare. So let's say the feds tell the U of I police department, hey, hold on to this individual because we want to come question him, so you have to hold him for 2 or 3 days till we can get there. Unless there's a statute that conditions federal dollars on the University of Illinois' promise to cooperate with Homeland Security in that way, then it's up to the state of Illinois, which may, and it, this decision may be decided in Springfield, or Springfield may delegate it down to the university or to each city or county. But it's up to the state to decide how much they want to comply, unless there is some funding mechanism in which the state has already promised to assist.
Right. And so it sounds like it's an interesting question. We've just got about a minute before we take a break, Vic, and we'll continue this conversation on the other side of this. But it sounds to me like a lot of this actually, you're saying, resides at the state level, not necessarily at the municipal level. There's a lot of these decisions do reside at the decisions of different state officials. Is that correct?
It is correct, only to the extent that the state decides to make that decision itself rather than to leave it to the city. So Springfield could say, and I'm sure there are bills that are proposed that say this, that no city or municipality should assist the federal government in immigration enforcement any more than is required by funding laws. But other states might say, it's up to each city or county to do what they want, and at the state level, we are delegating that authority more locally. So it really just depends on what the decision at the state capital level is, whether to resolve it one way or the other, or whether to delegate. Now, in Texas, for example,
I'm going to just stop you there for a second, I'm afraid, because we've got to take a break. But that's Vikram Amar, Dean of University of Illinois Law School, constitutional law scholar. We're talking about this issue of states versus the federal government regarding immigration. We'll continue this conversation on the other side of this short break.
The 21st is made possible by the library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing students and scholars for their fields by offering access to today's cutting-edge equipment and technology within advanced library environments and facilities. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about immigration and the law, what states can and cannot do in response to the federal government's approach to enforcing immigration law. We've been speaking with Vikram Amar. He's a constitutional law scholar. He's also dean of the University of Illinois College of Law, along with Sarah Dady, an immigration attorney with Dady and Hoffman in Rockford. We've got lots of questions that we've been gathering from you, mostly on Reddit and Facebook. By the way, you can always search for our Facebook page to like us. That's where you can weigh in with questions that you'd like us to ask on air. We're taking your questions live as well. If you like, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet. Our handle is 21stshow. I wanted to just kind of pick up that point you were making about states, because I feel like I was sort of laughing that whenever you ask a lawyer a question, there's always going to be a follow up of a but. So I wanted to give you the chance to follow up on that. How much states are setting or not setting? And I wonder if we could even think about, so for example, what we've seen with Chicago and Urbana passing resolutions, city councils passing resolutions saying we are sanctuary cities. First of all, we don't really have a definition. There is no legal definition for sanctuary city, correct, Vic?
That is correct. It's a term that means different things in different places. But as a general matter, I think we can agree that it means that a jurisdiction does not want to help Homeland Security any more than it absolutely has to at a minimum. And to complete what I was saying before the break, assuming there is no conditional federal funding requirements that obligates the states or cities to participate with the feds in any particular way because they've accepted federal dollars, assuming that's not in the picture, then some state legislatures could say, we don't want any of our local governments helping the federal enforcement. Some, like Texas, might say, we want all of our cities and localities to affirmatively help the federal government. And other states might say, we're going to leave it up to each city or municipality to decide for itself. So At the initial cut, the decision is going to be made at the state legislative level, but that decision may be to push the decision down to the cities and locals in some states where they want some intrastate diversity.
Mm-hmm. So thank you. That answers Dorothy's question about what exactly a sanctuary city is. Timothy on Facebook had another question that I think leads into this. Vic, I'm going to ask you, and then Sarah, if you can follow up. What can states, Timothy wants to know, what can states and cities do to protect undocumented people in their communities?
Well, again, they can't obstruct federal enforcement. So if they try to block the federal agents' access to individuals, or if they lie and provide false information to the federal government, then they violated even the most ambitious state federalism powers. So there's not that much they can do to interfere with the feds, but what they can do is not assist the feds. They can decide not to provide resources. They can decide not to, detain or hold people. Unless there is federal funding at issue, that's a decision that the state can make on its own, not to assist.
Sarah, what do you think? I'm thinking in particular when you're asked, when Timothy's asking what states and cities can do to protect undocumented people. I imagine you would want to throw in another thing in there. What can individual people do as well, right? Because you've been involved in a lot of individual efforts.
Absolutely. I would echo what Dean Amar said. Not assist is the big thing. Illinois has the Trust Act, which hopefully Governor Rauner will sign, which will prohibit.
Can you explain what the Trust Act?
Sure. Yeah. The Trust Act prohibits state local law enforcement or state law enforcement from enforcing federal civil immigration laws. So that is the not assist statute. Do not cooperate. Do not obstruct, but don't assist.
And I should point out, we haven't heard from Governor Rauner yet a specific stance on this issue, correct?
That is correct. So anyone who wants to call a governor and urge him to sign it, that's fine.
Sarah, that's Sarah's opinion that she's sharing there.
That is
as
my
always,
opinion.
As always, all opinions are welcome on the 21st. If you feel differently, you can call us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. I want to shift to something else. As we talk about how this is actually playing out in interaction on a day-to-day basis, I want to go back to a conversation that we had on the 21st back in April when we spoke with an attorney in downtown Urbana. And we were talking about immigration enforcement and how this is affecting other folks who are not here legally or have overstayed, whatever their situation is, how this is affecting other court proceedings. She shared this story, Ruth Wyman, who's an attorney. She's not an immigration attorney. She shared the story of being with a client at the courthouse in Urbana for a pretrial hearing for a first-time alleged DUI charge. Federal immigration authorities arrested her client at a mall right after this hearing.
Three white men in plain clothes approached him and asked him if he was, and then said his name. He said yes. And they showed a badge and said, "We're from ICE," and said, "We're here to arrest you."
That's Ruth Wyman on the 21st back in April, an attorney in downtown Urbana. Sarah, is this a common practice for ICE agents to find and arrest people without direct help from city officials?
Yes. I mean, that's ICE's job. They're charged with locating people who are violating immigration laws and to arrest them. We're seeing more and more of this since President Trump rescinded President Obama's memorandums about who should be priorities for arrests on immigration violations. And also, under President Obama, ICE was restricted from going to certain safe areas like churches.
Okay, because that's
schools.
Another question we got. We had a listener on Reddit who asked, is there anything, is that a myth that ICE can't arrest you in a church or school?
No, it's not a myth, but we have to understand that ICE is federal law enforcement. They're subject to constitutional restraints like any law enforcement agency. Any church or school can have a policy that they are not going to allow access to their building without a warrant signed by a judge. And that would affect.
And that gets back to this earlier question we were talking about.
Well, and that would absolutely hamstring ICE because they do not have warrants signed by judges.
We also had a question that's, I think, a little more basic. Sarah, I wonder if you could answer that we also had a listener ask, which is, what do local police do to deport people who are here illegally as well as legal immigrants who've committed crimes?
Well, local police are not charged with enforcing civil laws, let alone federal laws.
So just to be clear, that's not a job of local police.
That is correct. I mean, local police are interested in fighting crime, assisting victims of crime. That's where their focus is. Now, individuals can certainly call ICE, and there have been a few incidents where a police officer or a sheriff's deputy would ask somebody if they're here illegally or not and proactively call ICE. But from what I understand, there are no sheriff's departments that have a policy that encourage officers or deputies to do that. Those are isolated incidents.
Right. When you mentioned sheriffs, in fact, last month, we'll tweet out this story. The Washington Post reported that 85% of sheriffs agree there should be more federal spending to prevent illegal immigration. 70% believe they should be able to ask about an individual's citizenship status during routine patrols. How important do you think those statistics are when you're thinking about sheriff's offices and their attitudes and how much that reflects here?
I think it does reflect, but, you know, this is a broader conversation. The problem is we have immigration laws that don't do what we want them to do, that don't provide people a lawful way to come in the first place when our economy demanded that they come. So I understand the attitude, well, people need to do it the right way. But we need to understand undocumented immigrants need to be given a right way. And that's a task that falls with Congress. So I don't think anybody wants to continue to remain unlawfully in the United States with that kind of insecurity and threat of deportation. I think that if Congress gave them a way to apply for lawful status, they would line up immediately to do so. So in the meantime, do we continue with this de facto amnesty? Do we continue to have harsh deportation detention enforcement? Or are we actually going to act to do something positive to allow people to get right with the law?
That's Rockford immigration attorney Sarah Dady. She's with the firm Dady & Hoffman. We're talking about the line, what the law is, all of this in the context of immigration enforcement between federal authorities and state and municipalities. My other guest is the dean of the University of Illinois Law School, Vikram Amar. He's a constitutional law scholar. Vic, we had another question from Scott on Facebook that I wanted to direct to you. Scott says, I've seen pastors and ministers inviting non-documented immigrants to take sanctuary at their churches, public officials inviting non-documented immigrants to come to their cities. Scott wants to know, is this illegal speech? It's not violence, but to him it seems to be an incitement of lawless action because it's calling, he says, for people to break immigration laws. What's your understanding of, I'm kind of curious your thoughts on that.
Well, it's pretty clear to me that that speech is fully protected under the First Amendment. It's true that you cannot incite somebody to break the law, but the incitement exception to protected speech under the First Amendment is very narrow. You have to be exhorting an individual who's really right there and who's going to act imminently. I understand these calls to be much more abstract and much more political in the statements that they're making. So whether you think they're good or not to make, I think they're protected under the First Amendment. But I want to go back to also something you and Ms. Dady talked about a moment ago, and that is, you know, this interrelationship between the legal and the political. Nyla, you mentioned that people are arrested when they are in courthouses for other business. You know, that makes it hard for localities to administer justice if individuals are afraid to come to court because they're worried that the feds are going to pick them up when they're there. Indeed, the Chief Justice of California, the head of the Supreme Court of California, wrote a letter to Homeland Security telling them to knock it off, that this was bad business and they shouldn't be, to use her words, stalking outside courthouses. I thought that was a loaded term, but again, that's an example of how much of this debate is political, because as a legal matter, I think the feds have a right to be in any public place that you can't exclude them from a public place where others are allowed to come. And it may seem kind of aggressive and sleazy to hang out near courthouses, but the feds can do that under the law. The same is actually true with churches and schools. Now, it may be true that a church or a school could deny access to any law enforcement official without a warrant, but then the feds may be able to get a warrant, or maybe if these are administrative processes, a different kind of warrant is all that is required for certain kinds of searches. But the bigger point is a lot of this is political. The reason the feds don't go to churches is not because they couldn't legally get whatever is needed to go there. It's that it would look so bad politically, which dovetails back to Ms. Dady's point about the dialogue here has to be political as well as legal.
What I wonder, as you think about that, I wonder, Vic, if you could place this era and this political conversation into, certainly we can go back to the Civil War. This has been a longstanding debate, states' rights versus federal rights in this country, right? This is a longstanding tension that is sort of inherent to the fabric of our political structure and our government. So I wonder where I'm just sort of curious, as someone who studies the Constitution, as a constitutional law scholar, where you see this current debate, if you can help us sort of place this era when we think about states versus the federal government in context.
It's a very interesting and important question, because as you kind of intimated, a generation or two ago, proponents of states' rights tended to be on the conservative side of the spectrum. So, for example, the two cases from the 1990s that established that so-called anti-commandeering principle I mentioned earlier, that said that the feds can't order states to do the federal government's enforcement or its bidding, those involved efforts by the federal government to force states to get involved in environmental regulation and gun control. And those cases were decided 5-4, with the conservative justices siding with the states who had the autonomy not to cooperate with the feds if they didn't want to. It'll be interesting to see what conservative justices do when these cases get to the Supreme Court today in the context of an inverted situation where the states and localities are on the more progressive side. Will they stick to their states' rights stance? Will they create an immigration exception that gives the federal government more power here than it had in the area of gun control or environmental regulation? It's going to be interesting to see. You see the same kind of inversion, on college campuses, where conservative speakers are being shouted down, I think quite wrongly. I think people have a right to speak, and you may not like what they have to speak, but Ann Coulter should be able to speak at Berkeley. But that's different than a generation ago, when it was kind of the radicals who were being roughed up by mobs and or police.
Question for you, Vic. Do you think this ultimately will be a question that will be decided by the Supreme Court?
I think sooner or later, some variant of the sanctuary city issue will get to the Supreme Court. It may involve a particular funding statute. And the question might be how clearly Congress has to identify the conditions of cooperation before it can use the lever of federal monies to get states to do what they want. But I think, if you look back on the war on terror, if you look back on the financial crisis, sooner or later, all of these monster political, social disputes find their way to the Supreme Court in some package or another.
Well, and I would think, Sarah, you would also agree that certainly given and Vic, the amount of time it has taken for Congress to not agree on comprehensive immigration reform, which is the other part of this, Vic, I mentioned timing-wise, it seems more likely it's faster that this issue would be resolved in the Supreme Court than in Congress.
Yes, but this goes back to Ms. Dady's point. The Supreme Court will decide a case which will tend to be narrow and legalistic.
Right.
This issue is something that the court can't decide on its own. This issue is much bigger than any judge or any case.
That's Vikram Amar, Dean of the College of Law at the University of Illinois, constitutional law scholar. We'll tweet out some of Vic's been doing lots of writing on this. We'll tweet some of that out as well for folks who are interested. I want to thank as well Sarah Dady, a Rockford-based immigration attorney who's been here with me in our studios in Chicago with the firm Dady and Hoffman. Thanks to all of our listeners for all of your questions. You can always chime in on Facebook as well. We'll continue the conversation there. Search for our page to like us. Sarah, Vic, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. In the 1830s, tens of thousands of Native Americans were removed from their homes in the southeastern U.S. and forced to march west for hundreds of miles. Thousands of people died along the way due to disease and starvation. The paths that Native Americans were forced to walk became known as the Trail of Tears. Today, the memory of the Trail of Tears lives on for Native Americans, and for members of the Cherokee Nation, that path ran through southern Illinois. It may come as a surprise to you that the Trail of Tears ran through our state, but last month, three Trail of Tears sites in southern Illinois were added to the National Register of Historic Places. That's the official list of historic sites overseen by the National Park Service. We're joined now from the Cherokee Nation by Troy Poteet. He's Executive Director of the Trail of Tears Association. Troy, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate you taking the time.
I'm glad to be here.
Troy, what does... Yeah, thank you so much. I wonder if you can explain to us what it means to you to have these Trail of Tears sites marked as official historic sites.
I think that the marking of these sites, tribal folks look on this as an opportunity to tell a broader story. It gives us opportunity to honor the endurance, the perseverance, the strength of our ancestors who did not let the tragedy of forced removal defined their lives. They came to what's now Oklahoma, and they rebuilt the Cherokee Nation, and they passed it on to the next generation, a distinct political entity. They didn't let removal destroy us. So when we look at these events, it's an opportunity for us to honor them, not as victims, but as people who overcame.
And Troy, when you think about that, I think about the fact that I know now many Native Americans today, in honor, as you said, of this, retrace steps that that your ancestors were forced to walk. And I think when you think about that, I know this is a big question, but I wonder if you can help explain, especially for our non-Native audience, what the Trail of Tears, what you think it represents, especially for the Cherokee Nation?
Especially for us, it represents a testimony to our ancestors' perseverance and their will to survive as a tribe, as a distinct public political entity. So when we look at that, it's a symbol that we come from a background of people committed to the preservation and of the Cherokee Nation, and its perpetuation is the word I'm looking for, to mm-hmm. the preservation and perpetuation of our tribe. That's what we see when we look at that. Yes, we see injustice. Yes, we see a tragedy, but we don't like to perpetuate the image of our ancestors as victims. And we don't look at this and say, golly, somehow we want to appropriate that victimization to ourselves. That's not it. The idea is that they had to endure that, and they rebuilt notwithstanding. And so when we're coming across southern Illinois just a day or two ago, maybe only yesterday, a group of young Cherokees are riding. They're organized into an annual Remember the Removal bike ride, and they travel across the same area that our ancestors did, stop at some of the same places that our ancestors stopped. They're joined, our Cherokee Nation youth are joined by people from the Eastern Band of Cherokees, those folks who managed to stay in the original homelands. And the young folks are able to make that ride because of volunteers in the local communities, like the Illinois chapter of the Trail of Tears Association, like Dr. Wagner and Sandy Boaz. They have been partners with the Trail of Tears Association in helping the Park Service find exactly where did the route go, are there sites there, are there places that were there that were witness to what happened in 1838 and 1839.
That's Troy Poteet from the Cherokee Nation, Executive Director of the Trails of Tears Association. We're talking about the fact that the National Park Service, the National Register of Historic Places, last month added 3 Trail of Tears sites in southern Illinois to the register. I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. The man who helped propose some of these sites to the National Park Service, Mark Wagner, is an associate professor and director of the Center for Archaeological Investigations at Southern Illinois University, joining us on the line from Carbondale. Mark, thanks for being with us as well.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Mark, as we're hearing Troy talk about these specific sites that some young folks were just writing of just recently, can you tell us a little bit about these sites? One was a campground, one was a church. What happened there?
Oh, sure. Well, in the winter of 1838 and 1839, the northern route of the Trail of Tears ran through southern Illinois, and over 10,000 Cherokee traveled along that route in very bad weather. And there were several locations that they would stop at and camp at. And two of those are Campground Church and Cemetery. And that was an existing, kind of like a revival or a campground for religious meetings. And the other one is called the Bridges Tavern. And taverns in the 19th century are more like hotels. And it also had a big campground associated with it. And there were so many people in these groups. Some of these groups numbered over 1,000 people. And they could not, there was not enough room in southern Illinois to accommodate them. So they needed places to camp. And two of the places were, again, Bridges and Campground Cemetery. And Campground Cemetery, while the Cherokee were camping there, several of the Cherokee, we don't know how many, died. And the man who owned the property, who was Mr. Holloman, two of his sons had died just the year before. And it was the start of the campground cemetery. And he allowed the Cherokee to bury next to his sons. And that area where the Cherokee are buried has always been kept vacant in the center of the cemetery. So we know where those graves are. And so that is one of the sites that got nominated. We have a very strong historic association, historic records for it. But also, a few years ago, a geologist at SIU, Dr. Harvey Henson, used ground-penetrating radar to survey that area where the Cherokee burials are reportedly located. And he did, in fact, find evidence without digging, got signals that there were graves in that area. And so we were able to make that argument that this indeed is a Trail of Tears site and should be placed on the National Register. The Bridges Tavern is it's a very similar sort of place. It was a frontier hotel, but it had a large campground next to it, and it also had things that the Cherokee would have needed. It had like a blacksmith. It had a mill to grind corn, all these things that a number of people would have needed. And one of the things that at the Bridges site was that there was a log store that they were able to purchase things at. Well, that log store still exists inside a modern barn at that site. And so we went out there a couple of years ago, and we did archaeology and we did archival research, and we also documented the log structure in detail. And it does appear to go back to at least the mid-1800s, and it has a oral history, a very strong oral history, that it was a store, and it does indeed appear to be a store building. So again, in this case, we're able to make the argument by tying together archaeology and archival and oral history that this indeed was a place where the Cherokee stopped. And this log building is one of the very, very few extant buildings along the trail. There may be one or two other ones.
Troy, are there other actual buildings that still exist along the trail, or is this a rare site that we have in Illinois?
There are many structures along the Trail of Tears. There are several, I guess I should say, not many, and we're in the process of identifying those, and so Dr. Wagner has some counterparts in other parts of the country who are busy about finding these sites. We have chapters in 9 states that the trail touched, and in each state there are several structures.
And Troy, I wonder if you could illuminate for us. Oh, go ahead, Doctor. Go ahead, Mark Wagner. Go ahead.
Oh, my point was that in Illinois, there are only a very, very few, maybe one or two. For the entire trail. I'm talking about southern Illinois.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that. And also, Mark, can you tell us specifically where these first two sites, where they're exactly located, what towns they're in?
Yeah, Campground Cemetery is located east of Anna, Illinois, in Union County, and it still has an active Presbyterian church at it. And, it's an active church and a cemetery, and there are interpretive signs there. And so people can go out and, read it and look at the interpretive signs put up by the National Park Service. The Bridges Tavern is on private property in Johnson County, and that the structure is not visible from the road. And you would have to arrange, if someone wanted to go see it, they would have to arrange with the owner to be allowed to go see it. And then finally, I was going to mention the third site that people can go see also in southern Illinois is on the Shawnee National Forest in Union County, and it is west of Jonesboro, and it's called Hamburg Hill Trail. And this is where a section of the trail ascended a very high ridgetop, which is Hamburg Hill. And the trail, all the traffic, not only of the Cherokee, but of other travelers along the trail, have worn this deep trail cut into the ridgetop. It's probably as much as 20 feet deep. And so we actually have a living link to the landscape that the Cherokee would have seen. When you go out to Hamburg Hill, you see there are no modern buildings, no modern structures, no telephone poles. You see the same landscape that they would have seen in the 1830s traveling down through that trail cut.
Wow, that's quite a view to think that hasn't changed during that time. That's Mark Wagner, who's an associate professor in anthropology. He's also the director of the Center for Archaeological Investigations at SIU in Carbondale, talking about these historic sites. Troy Poteet, who's with us as well, who's executive director of the Trail of Tears Association from the Cherokee Nation. Troy, you started this conversation by saying that I think what struck me was a lot of this to you is about story, not just obviously the story of the Trail of Tears, but the story after. I was surprised to even learn that there were sites in Illinois where this even happened. I wonder how much of this is about sharing not just that past story, but the current, as you said, sort of the story after the Trail of Tears with everyone across the United States.
I think that it's both. It gives us an opportunity to talk about a bigger story about this, that our ancestors did persevere and hold the tribe together, and that we did prosper again in a new land, and that we are today again enjoying a new age of prosperity and revitalization of our language and our culture and our traditions. Right now, we are overcoming what happened when we were forced to become part of the state of Oklahoma, and our land base was divided against the wishes of our people, against their advice, and 90% of Cherokee's land was lost between 1906 and 1936 when the droughts and the Dust Bowl hit. And so we are overcoming in this current age what happened at that time when our people became strangers in their own land and fell into poverty because of it. So it's an opportunity for us to tell that larger story. But the work that, like Dr. Wagner is doing, Sandy Boaz is president of the Illinois chapter, Mary Corvey at the Forest Service is part of that. There's a huge number of people, a good good-sized number of people who donate their time and their talent to determine exactly where the trail ran, what sites are there. And so that's where our history intersects the history of the people in southern Illinois. There are many stories about people coming out. They wanted to bring blankets or medicine. They couldn't go into the camps because there was disease broke out and they were sort of quarantined. There's all these sort of stories that connect us as Cherokees with the people in southern Illinois. So we, every year it seems like we appreciate the partnerships that we are able to develop with people.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. Yeah, thanks so much for sharing those partnerships. I'm afraid we're out of time today for the 21st, but I want to thank Troy Poteet from the Cherokee Nation for joining us to learn a little bit more about this. You've been listening to the 21st, a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.